Health and Public Advocacy to order. And for the record, Representative Walker is excused. She's doing some independent research on emergency rooms. But also, we believe she's fine. This is just precautionary at this point. But it was an exciting way to start committee.
Huh? I already voted for them.
You want to make a statement?
Yes.
Okay, Diane.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, I have at your place given you a memo on House Bill 3218. The insurance division did respond to the public hearing that you had on the 12th. So I wanted you to have a copy of that response to things that they heard while they were listening into that committee meeting. So that's that on that.
Okay. Did we get this thing at all? Or?
Uh-huh.
Okay. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2438. Representative Morissette.
Okay, I move to adopt the amendments to...
No, no.
Oh, suspend the rules?
Yeah.
Go ahead and start the...
Oh, okay. Okay. Mr. Chair, I move to suspend the rules for the purpose of reconsidering House Bill 2438.
Representative Morissette has moved to suspend the rules. Is there any objections? Hearing none, the rules are suspended. Representative Morissette.
Okay, I move that we... adopt the amendments, the dash two amendments, and repass the bill out of committee as amended. Send it to Ways and Means. Chair Cruz.
Yeah.
Move that committee reconsider House Bill 2438 for the purposes of bringing the bill back to committee and reconsidering previous motions to adopt amendments.
Okay, Representative Morissette moves to reconsider House Bill 2438. Is there any discussion, any objections?
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I may have missed the earlier conversation, and I apologize for that.
But, there was none. But
okay, I don't know why we're doing it. That would be useful to me to know.
Representative Barnhart and members of the committee, it was discovered after this bill had been passed out of committee with the dash one amendments that had replaced the bill, that in section five of those dash one amendments, there was language that would have made in-home care workers self-employed for the purpose of allowing them to become eligible for the Oregon Health Plan. It was discovered through conversations in legislative fiscal office that they believed that this would cause concerns that Oregon would then have to request a waiver from HIPAA, the Healthcare Financing Administration, in order to implement that portion of the bill. So with the proponents and discussions with the chair, there was agreement to remove that language and only that language from the bill. And so we created a new amendment, and the bill had to come back to committee in order to have that fixed.
I got it.
So that's what's happening right now.
Thank you. That's very helpful.
Certainly.
Okay.
So there's a motion to make a sense.
Okay. Any objections? Hearing none. So adopted. So we are now reconsidering House Bill 2438, and I would entertain a motion to adopt the dash two amendments.
Okay, I move the dash two amendments.
Okay, Representative Morissette has moved the dash two amendments to House Bill 2438. Any discussion? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I think I've said this in previous testimony that I believe that a lot of this could be taken care of in rules rather than, especially the area on employment and wages and compensation. I think setting compensation in statute, I don't think that's appropriate, and I'll leave it at that. I've said it before, and I say it again.
Okay. Any other discussion? Hearing none, clerk call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Morse?
Aye.
Representative Berard?
Aye.
Representative Montanson?
No.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
This is on the amendment.
Yes.
I vote aye on the amendment.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. Having received the required majority, the dash two amendments are adopted.
Yeah, I move, Mr. Chair, that House Bill 2438 be sent to Ways and Means to pass that as amended.
Okay. Representative Morissette has moved that we repass the bill out of committee as amended and send it to the Committee on Ways and Means. Any discussion? Representative Lee.
Is it with due pass or without a recommendation?
Due pass.
Due pass, excuse me.
I think I would be more comfortable with no recommendation, given some of the problems the bill has.
I would be happy to change them to just send it to Ways and Means and let them decide, with no recommendation.
Okay, Representative Morissette, that was a friendly amendment to your motion, and it is accepted. So the motion now is to send to Ways and Means with no recommendation. And
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I have a question. Is it normal procedure to put in statute wages, compensation? It seems to me that it's more appropriately done, especially as I understand it, that one of the issues that the voters voted on was to enable this group of workers to unionize. So isn't it appropriate then for this to be, for wages to be an issue of negotiation?
We will ask Jack when to come up and speak to the question.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jacqueline Zimmer. I'm the director of the Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities Statewide Association. In response to your question, Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei, it's not necessarily that we want to put the wages in statute. It's the increase for responding to the training programs and to stay on the job. And the reason that we want to put that in statute is because these people historically are not paid very well for the work that they do. In fact, in statute right now is that they're paid $1 an hour over minimum wage. And so what we're trying to do is just establish a base. What we did do already was establish a base pay rate for them. And the language in this bill establishes, it doesn't speak to the base pay rate, it just speaks to an increase for training that they go through and for time spent on the job.
Follow up, please. Thank you. Jacqueline, I'm very sympathetic with these workers, and I know how hard they work and how poorly they've been compensated. But isn't it normally that all of these issues would be dealt with in negotiation, especially if they were unionized? Isn't that part of the issue that they will be unionized? Isn't that part of the expectation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, it is not necessarily a fact that these people will be unionized, and we may have to call the folks that organized the home care campaign to respond more articulately to that. But what it does, the Home Care Commission does set up an employer of record for these people. It's not quite the same as making them a union unless they eventually choose to do so, and it's basically they could choose to function as a home care commission without necessarily agreeing to all join a union.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are, if I'm stating that correctly, so it is just that, again, these people are considered domestic help and as such have no position from which to bargain from. And in the past, that's why we've had to get their wages, that's why we've pushed for their wages to be set by the legislature, a minimum wage for them to be set by the legislature. I'm not sure.
Do you understand my discomfort with this? I mean, if I were they, I might want more than what the statute we're giving them. It just seems real inappropriate that we're putting this in law rather than having this an issue that they will negotiate.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I do see your point. And the reason that we, again, push for this to be in statute is when we started this legislation, actually, this may be the third session we've come forward with this request for this group of people. And in the course of that, all we've been able to do is get them a dollar an hour increase over minimum wage. And as a result of that, the Home Care Commission and the initiative was founded and took off and went to the voters. The purpose of us doing this is such that it could be some time before that commission is fully up and running and before the people have made decisions about what course they want to take. It could take another legislative session before their issue is addressed, any of their fiscal issues are addressed. And so we're trying to address their needs in the meantime, and they're more than welcome to come back and negotiate for some other sort of wages or benefits as they see fit. But in the meantime, it's important for us to continue to keep this issue in front of them and for them not to have to wait 2 more years to get an increase because they've done some additional training or because they have stayed on the job. So I do recognize, you know, the source of your discomfort, and I share that. But so far, that discomfort, I mean, we haven't been able to address these issues any other way. So
okay.
The state's not willing to sort of step up, and the legislature's not been willing to really fund this program at the level it is entitled to.
Yeah. Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Morissette.
I understand that, and I think there needs to be a floor established from which to bargain. And I think that's what you're doing. And I also, it strikes me that even though I was on this committee last year that heard this, I didn't remember all of the details, but you know, it's another argument for extending the, you know, allowing people to be here long enough to remember these issues. You know, if we were here several terms in a row, we would see the issues that keep coming back each time, and we would be better able to deal with them. And, you know, it's difficult for all of us new people. I'm not, you know, I'm a second term, but I'm still new.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I guess I understand what you're saying, and I support what you're saying, because it seems logical that there would be some kind of a base established from which they could bargain.
Any other questions? Thank you, John.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Call the roll.
Representative Tomei?
Aye.
Representative Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Montanison?
No.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2438, having once again received the required majority, is declared passed, and I close the work session on 2438. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on 2068.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 2068 deals with medical savings accounts. It removes premium limitation restrictions and certain coverage requirements for the group high deductible health benefit plans associated with medical savings accounts. I did give you in your packet some information about some of the sort of historical data associated with medical savings accounts, and within my summary also the 1996 demonstration project that was created by Congress.
Which I'm sure you've all read.
I'm sure.
Yep. Okay. Jim C. Graves. Please go ahead.
Chairman Cruz and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in favor of this bill. State state law now requires that small employer health plans be substantially equivalent to the coverage provided by the Oregon health plan. Many small employers have limited financial resources, and this basic health package is expensive. It costs about $2,500 per employee per year. Government mandates may seem attractive because they protect the employee. However, they cause many employers and employees to drop health benefits, and that adds to the number of uninsured in Oregon. Premiums for individual high deductible PPO MSA plans in Oregon are about 40% of the cost of individual group, individual non-high deductible plans or group plans. These policies typically have a $5 million lifetime maximum, a $2,250 annual deductible, a $3,000 maximum annual out-of-pocket cost. These are the federal standards for MSAs, and allow an individual or an employer to deposit $1,462 or 65% of the deductible per year tax-free into their MSA. They include generous mental health, maternity, and chiropractic benefits above the deductible. Such policies are not now available to employer groups in Oregon because of the many mandates that are associated with such plans. The next two pages describe the mandates that we proposed deleting in 2068. Three bills have been introduced to address this problem. Senate Bill 8, House Bill 2068, and House Bill 3553. These concepts need to be combined into an effective bill that will make basic health plans, including high deductible medical savings accounts plans, available to Oregonians. The approach in 2068 was just to exempt medical savings account plans from the high deductible medical savings account plans from these mandates. The last page in the handout gives some current health insurance costs. Note that for Florida's policies in Oregon, a 20-year-old pays about $57 a month. These are for individual policies. Blue Shield of California is selling a similar policy in the northern counties for $31 a month. Their $25 and 25% copay plan, an attractive PPO plan, sells for $141 a month. You notice there also the amounts charged for a 50-year-old, a person between 50 and 59 years of age. These comparisons of the premiums do not reflect the main big advantage associated with allowing group MSA plans to be sold in Oregon. The big advantage is that other medical expenses, such as dental care, mental health below the deductible, acupuncture, travel to and from medical care, these become excludable from taxable income as long as they're purchased from one's self-insured MSA account. Representative Cruz and members of the committee, do you have any questions?
That's Senator Lee.
Thank you. Jim, if the coverage for mammograms and pap smears, et cetera, are not included in the policy, can they be deducted from the deductible as some of the out-of-pocket costs without any disadvantage under this? Or are they not able to be used in any way at all in calculating the deductible?
Representative Lee and members of the committee, we are not absolutely certain that this is the best list of mandates to be excluded, as you notice with the asterisk that I've inserted beside these. If the cost of mammograms and pap smears are first dollar coverage required in Oregon law as first dollar coverage, then that would be in conflict with the basic concept of an MSA, which would pay for those from self-insured MSA account. I don't know whether that answers your question.
Mr. Chairman? Representative Bill Witt, I think I heard Representative Lee's question. I think the answer, Representative, is yes. Those would be procedures that one could extract money from one's MSA account to pay for the health care procedure, of course, using pre-tax dollars, because the dollars that you put into your MSA account, you can then pull down and use for medical expenses that are either not covered or are less than the deductible.
Any other questions? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, I've had the opportunity to work with Mr. Seagraves over the last two or three years on a number of bills that are designed to control health care costs. This specific bill, I think, is a good example of that, because what it does is it recognizes the current impediment in the law in Oregon that makes it really impractical, if not impossible, to use MSA in group health care policies, because all the mandates that Oregon law ties to those policies. Because of that, many Oregonians are not getting the benefit of lower-cost health care policies, the kinds of policies that you can do with MSAs. And as Representative Lee's question just pointed out, as you build up your MSA account, these kinds of medical practices or procedures that you need, you can pay for with pre-tax dollars that you have put into your account. So this is a way to try to make insurance more affordable for more people, particularly for smaller businesses and for their employees. And it's a way to make sure that we have more Oregonians that have health care coverage in this state. By eliminating some of these mandates, we make these programs practical and make it possible for them to be used by smaller businesses and their employees throughout the state of Oregon. So for that reason, I'm strongly supportive of this, because I think it goes to something we all believe in, which is making health care available for as many people as possible and making coverage as affordable as possible. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, this is a freshman question, I think, Representative Witt. And that is, it would be helpful to me to understand how the medical savings account plan that we're talking about is supposed to work. I mean, I understand this comes as a result of a federal scheme that Congress put in place quite several years ago, and we're trying to, it sounds like what we're talking about here is conforming the state system to that federal plan to some extent. And it would be useful to me, I think, if somebody would describe that federal plan and maybe hit at least just the high points of where we're not working, how we're not working.
Maybe I can just briefly respond, Mr. Chairman, to Representative Barnhart's question, and then we'll ask Mr. Seagraves to respond in more detail. But generally, the way an MSA works is that an individual will buy a high deductible, catastrophic type coverage plan. That individual will set aside a certain amount of dollars pre-tax on a regular basis into an account which they control, which is to be used for health care purposes. The individual then can draw money out of the account to pay for medical procedures that are not covered by the catastrophic plan. because it's all done with pre-tax dollars, you get the tax benefit, of course, but also it creates an incentive for the individual to consume healthcare services wisely, because what you're doing is you're using the dollars that you set aside and invested, presumably in a very circumspect, responsible way, because you draw down your account as you do it. If you don't use the dollars continue to accumulate and they're available for you to use down the road. But then you do have coverage for the more catastrophic, you know, the more expensive type procedures. Maybe Mr. Seagraves would like to elaborate on that.
Representative Cruz and Representative Barnhart and members of the committee, the federal law is being changed, will probably be changed, to remove the time limit and the numeric limit on the number of medical savings accounts policies. There's also a measure to remove the limit on the amount that can be deposited in the medical savings account to make it equal to the annual deductible, and a number of other provisions that will make MSAs more attractive. The Oregon law follows federal law on this, so that the ability of Oregonians to deduct what they have been putting into medical savings accounts has been in existence for some years, just following the federal tax law. So that privilege has not been available to employer groups. That's the basic issue that's being attacked with this bill, is that many individual self-employed Oregonians, a large number of doctors and veterinarians and so on, have bought MSA policies. They're very popular among certain groups, but they're not available to employee groups.
Representative Morsa.
Thank you. I guess I'd like to follow up, explain the business group part of it now. Employers, small business employers of what size will be eligible to participate in this with their employees? I don't understand that connection.
Right now, under federal law, Representative Morris said, and members of the committee, right now under federal law, only groups of less than 50 employees can be eligible for MSAs. But the amendments that are being considered by Congress at this time would make MSAs available to anybody, whether they're self-employed or not, and regardless of the employer size group. Does that answer your question?
I think so.
Any other questions? Senator Mona Sanderson.
Okay. I like Representative Weber for Seagraves.
Yeah.
Mr. Seagraves. I like the idea of having medical savings accounts, but what I don't like about the bill is putting in number B, section 2, sub B. It's basically getting rid of mandates. And I know insurance companies would love to have that, but it's very hard for me to go along with this bill with some of the mandates that you have in here. And I'm looking at mammograms, and I'm looking at pelvic exams and pap smears, and I'm looking at the diabetes management education, emergency services, all of those. That's the one piece of the bill, and I know that's the cost-saving piece that insurance companies are looking for.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson, please remember here that the purpose of an MSA is to buy a high deductible policy, and the requirement that the person who's buying the insurance is setting aside into an account pre-tax dollars at a certain amount that they put into an account and that they invest that can only be used for healthcare purposes. So the kinds of services you just mentioned are the kinds of relatively low-cost services that an MSA is designed to be used in such a way that you pay it out of your savings account, your MSA savings account. That's the specific purpose. That's the way an MSA works. It's designed to be used using your account dollars for those less expensive procedures. So the procedures you just described are typically fairly inexpensive procedures. They're exactly the kind of procedures that an MSA account is designed to be paid for from your MSA account, not by going to your insurer. So if you have the mandates that requires the insurer to cover these things, it defeats the entire purposes of an MSA account. Remember, we're requiring the individual who has the insurance to set aside into an account a certain amount of dollars every month and every year, and that account builds. Those are pre-tax dollars that are meant to be used specifically for health care. They can't be used to buy groceries. They can't be used to pay a mortgage. They're used for health care. Eventually, if you don't use them, you can roll them over into long-term care costs, you know, as you become elderly. But see, that's exactly what they're designed to be used for. So if you have the requirement, again, that the insurance company provide these in the insurance policy, you're defeating the entire purpose of an MSA, and that's what makes them impractical in Oregon.
Just follow up. Can you give an example then, say we have a high deductible, can you, and I think maybe the last page is trying to explain that to us, I'm not sure. Because I'd like to know is how much money are we talking about? How much money per month or per year would be going into this medical savings account?
Right. Representative Cruz and members of the committee, Representative Moniz Anderson, right now, an individual self-employed person in Oregon can only deposit 75% of their deductible for a family policy and 65% for an individual policy of the deductible that's chosen by them in the policy. We have another measure that we have proposed, 2069, that would make medical savings accounts available to people on the Oregon Health Plan, people whose income is below 200% of the poverty level. In that case, they would be required to put the 65% a year into their medical savings account, or they couldn't buy that kind of a health plan. I don't know whether I'm answering your question.
I guess I follow up. I just am a little bit, because I'm looking at the lower income people, and what then you're saying is they probably wouldn't qualify to be able to have an MSA? Is that what?
No.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, right now in Oregon, a typical MSA policy, and you may have this handout, so I hope I'm not reading this to you. Typically, have a $5 million lifetime maximum, a $2,250 annual deductible.
Show me which one.
I don't know if you have this particular handout.
It's on the front page.
Okay.
All right, typically, up to a $5 million lifetime maximum, a $2,250 annual deductible, a $3,000 maximum annual out-of-pocket, and allow an individual or an employer to deposit $1,462 per year tax-free into their MSA. So what the individual is doing because of this high deductible is they're depositing this money regularly into their MSA, and they're using those dollars specifically for the type of expenses that we are removing the mandate coverage on. So it's not, and remember, they're paying much less for the insurance because of this, because they have the high deductible insurance, but there's the requirement to deposit this money into the MSA account. So you have those dollars available to cover medical procedures which are not covered by the high deductible insurance policy. And of course, as those dollars accumulate, you can carry them forward from year to year to year. You can build the account up as big as it gets, and then you can, at some point down the road, you can use them for long-term care costs.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was referring that to Representatives Witt and Mr. Seagrave. Oh, thank you. One of the requirements that would not be required under this plan is alcoholism and mental or nervous conditions. Some of those can be very expensive, don't you agree?
Representative Tolman and members of the committee, yes, they can be. That's one of the mandates that I would like the committee to consider deleting from 2068.
Mr. Seagraves, if I may.
But right now we're talking about those expenses as being covered above the deductible.
But as I understand it, you were wanting not to have to cover expenses that were not very expensive, low-cost expenses to a family or an individual. Is that correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman. Representative, I think maybe I can respond to your question. Those expenses above the deductible would be covered. It's those expenses below the deductible that would be paid for out of your MSA account.
So if one were going into drug treatment or alcohol abuse treatment, and this was costing tens of thousands of dollars a year, that would be covered? Is that what you're saying?
Your policy, yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative, your policy kicks in after you rise above your deductible.
But I assume this was one of those that was not going to be mandated.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I'll let Mr. Seagraves comment on this as well. These mandates that we're talking about now are required in insurance policies point of the deductible. But there's a separation here between these costs prior to getting to your deductible and when you get beyond your deductible. But Mr. Seagraves, you want to comment on that?
My reading of the first mandate that we're proposing deleting, 556, is that employer groups in Oregon are required to cover those expenses above the deductible. The individual pays for his mental health and alcohol treatment and so on below the deductible. That's my understanding of the way the current law
it is now.
Yeah.
And you would like to see that change so that nothing would be covered by this plan?
I would like to minimize the number of mandates that apply to medical savings account.
And this would
plans.
Be one of them that you would like to eliminate. Is that correct?
Yes, this is one that I was proposing to eliminate, but I think that it's one of the mandates that is more popular to be mandated for both individual and group policies in Oregon. So that because it's so highly controversial, I put the asterisks by it as one that I think the committee should consider whether they want to include in the final bill.
Great. And if I may ask one more question, I'm assuming this is material also that you have a copy of. It's a study from Texas. Are you familiar with that, Mr. Seagraves?
No, I'm not, Representative.
And it's unfair to ask you. I just called your attention on page 5 of a study by Coopers and Librand. They say that any savings that result from the MSA approach are likely to come from decreased access to carrier and barriers created by the new cost sharing requirements. Would you have any response to that?
May I ask you to read it one more time?
Sure. I'll read it slower. Sorry. Any savings that result from the MSA approach are likely to come from decreased access to care and barriers created by new cost sharing requirements. And they go on to say that most likely result of an MSA program for the Medicaid population will be an increase in cost to the state and is therefore not cost effective. Maybe it's unfair to ask you because you haven't seen this.
I don't understand that those are valid points. I don't see the logic behind those points.
Okay, and I apologize if I'm putting you in an awkward position.
I'm going to cut this off because we got a lot of bills to do. We're not moving this today. There's a lot of information here. I invite you to look at it. I do think that the list of mandates needs to be looked at carefully. Representative Barnhart?
Yeah, I'd like to make a suggestion, if I may, before we move on. And I think but I'm beginning to get a sense of what this issue is about. And that is the idea that the mandates that we have in the health insurance rules now would prevent the MSA from being used because they apply down lower than the deductible under the MSA. This bill simply eliminates all the mandates according to the way the bill is written. In spite of what the proponents might think it says, that is what it says. What I would might suggest is that they consider an amendment to the bill that would allow for a large deductible on the accumulation of medical expenses, including the mandated items, so that the intention of the MSA gets carried out, and that is that early on in the medical year, you're paying your own bills, and only if you go over the deductible amount does the insurance kick in. But the way this thing is written now, what it basically does is eliminates all those mandates altogether, no matter how much money you spent on them. And I guess I'm curious as to whether that's what their intention was, or whether what they really intended to do was to make certain that you're going to pay your medical costs below the deductible amount, and then later on, if you go over the deductible amount, the insurance coverage would kick in. If that's the case, if the second is the case, I'd be willing to consider this bill some more with that amendment to make it clear that that's what we're talking about. Otherwise, I personally probably would not be interested in it.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Or Representative Barnhart, the other approach is to go through the list of mandates and determine which mandates you think the committee thinks needs to stay in and which can be removed and can be adequately addressed through the MSA savings account.
Could I make one more comment, if I may? And I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I apologize for this, but it might save us some time later. I'm looking on the third page of the material that starts relaxation of government mandates, that material. And on the third page, there are at least three mandates that look like there are ways of restricting things like portability, pre-existing condition issues, and methods of determining health status. But those don't seem to me to be related to mandates in the sense we're talking about at all, but rather as to who can buy in. And I mean, unless there's something really strange about my understanding of that, which is possible, I don't think they belong in the bill.
Thank you very much. Maybe Representative Witt, would you like to visit with Representative Barnhart on this at some point in time? And
I'll work with him on it.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2068, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3943.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, House Bill 3943 requires that at this time an undefined percent of money from a tax settlement be distributed each triennium for county health programs, including mental health programs. It requires the Department of Human Services to develop allocation plans and policies to be followed by each county and requires each county to distribute funds equally among public health programs and mental health programs.
First, I would like to call up Senator Carter. Thank you for waiting patiently, Senator. Good to see you.
Thank you.
You don't visit us often enough.
Shadows are with me today, Mr. Chairman.
See that.
My grandson from Tacoma and my other grandson who spent some time with him today. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be before this committee. I remember sitting there on many days in the past, 16 years as a matter of fact. So it's nice for you to give me the opportunity to come before you today on 3943. I'm Margaret Carter, Senate representative from Senate District 8, North Northeast Portland. So I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify. Unfortunately, Mr. Chairman, I put in for an amendment that is not ready at this particular point on this bill, so I've not received it from the Legislative Council yet. But what I would like to do with the tobacco bill is to propose some amendments that I feel would be appropriate here. I remember one of the things that happened when I ran for state school superintendent in 1998, Mr. Chairman, every place I went in rural Oregon, The thing that happened to me over and over again was that schools said to me that the health clinics, the school-based clinics, were not just being used for school-based purposes. Many people in the community who did not have access to health care were able to use school-based clinics for other community support issues in that community. And I thought that for us not to be able to have school-based clinics anymore, and again, let me especially say in rural Oregon, it disturbs me greatly. And so this bill and my proposal is to appropriate monies from the tobacco settlement and that it be distributed to each biennium for county health programs, mental health programs, and also safety net clinics. A safety net clinic is defined as a not-for-profit, tax-exempt, or public community-based facility providing primary medical care in a medically underserved area. You have in front of you, Mr. Chairman, by now, hope my proposed amendment to House Bill 3943, and I would appreciate your consideration of these amendments as you progress your work through this bill that is before you at this particular moment. If there are any questions, Mr. Chairman, I'd be more than glad to answer.
Any questions for the Senator? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you. I appreciate your amendment, Senator Carter. There are some other bills, too. There are some safety clinic bills out there and other school-based school nursing bills out there. And I agree with you that we have to have some mechanism, hopefully, and this could be one of them. Anyway, I appreciate the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson. I think that people don't realize the issue that is so broad, again, in rural Oregon, and of course, in districts like mine, but at least we have volunteer clinics that are working in urban Oregon that you don't see in rural Oregon. And the safety net clinics have been one of the means by which young people and community people in rural Oregon have access to health care. And so I think we need to stop fooling ourselves and believing that health care is available to everybody across the state, because it ain't. And we need to know that, and we need to do something to try to help provide it for our people in rural Oregon, as well as we do in the city, in our large cities in this state. So I'd appreciate your consideration.
I appreciate your consideration. I'd just let you know that House Bill 3225 we sent to Ways and Means, which was specifically a safety net clinic bill.
I'm glad. Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, these folks all want to come up together. Melinda Mowry, Bob Montgomery, Gene Cowan, Alan Melnick, and Gina Furman. That's what it says. It says together. And so we should have, but they'll have to do it in phases, I guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bob Montgomery. I'm representing Association of Community Health Programs. We're an organization of 36 counties. With me today is County Commissioner Gene Cowan from Lincoln County, Alan Melnick representing Public Health. We also have Gina Furman and Melinda Mowry from representing Mental Health. We're here to briefly lend our support to House Bill 3943 and thank the committee members for their introduction of the bill. Mr. Chair, I know you have a long day ahead of you with a lot of bills. My colleagues and I will be brief in our testimony, and we would like to answer any questions that you may have. And thank you all very much for your interest in mental health and public health. We need all the help we can get, and we'd like to ask Commissioner Cowan to kick it off, if I may, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, members of the committee, and Representative Cruz. I am Gene Cowan. I'm County Commissioner from Lincoln County. I'm also here today representing the Association of Oregon Counties as the priority team leader for our public health and mental health piece in this year's priorities that have been set by the Association of Oregon Counties. And I'm not going to go into detail. Others here can elaborate on the public health and mental health priority that we developed. I'm sure that you're aware that originally, we were following Department of Human Services directives when we were asked to examine county mental health and public health programs and look to see what the needs were. We did that. We identified the gaps that we have in our systems out there. We then had some funding included in the Department of Human Services budget, which did not make it into the governor's budget. And so we've sort of stepped back, and we recognize that there are still pieces of services that we're not able to provide in our communities. And we also recognize your challenges to the revenue flow in the general fund. And we are more than willing to look to the tobacco settlement dollars to meet some of those very critical needs. But I'm going to ask you, and then the others can get into a little more detail on that, I'm going to ask you to look at a little broader perspective here today. I'm seeing multiple approaches towards what I look at as a common goal. And I would like to recognize some of the other bills that are out there, looking at public health, mental health. And we're very appreciative that a number of people are taking a look at this. I am totally supportive of tobacco dollars going into those particular needs. But I think we also need to speak to the bigger spectrum of healthcare needs. In addition to the positions that I've identified for you, I'm also a member of the Oregon Health Council. And in that respect, I support funding for the Oregon Health Plan, which I think is a critical need. We've heard testimony here just today about school-based health centers, which fit into the spectrum of public or of safety net providers in our communities. I think that what I want to say is essentially we have got to look at the big picture. Healthcare includes public health care, the kind that we need to support in our communities, includes more than just one little piece. It is public health and mental health, and that's the population-based services that counties provide. It's also safety net clinics that include school-based health centers, and it's the Oregon Health Plan, which provides insurance to those who are income eligible. They're all critical components of our system, and I think that the courts recognized that when we got the tobacco settlement. They recognized the impacts of tobacco on health problems in our community. The public recognizes those needs, and we need to find a way to spend those dollars that's accountable to the public. And the legislature recognized these needs last time when they put public health and mental health into their suggested way of dealing with the tobacco settlement dollars. So what I'm here today to do is to urge you to recognize public health and mental health in this spectrum, and that we are a very critical component of that, but also to maybe consider taking a look at the whole spectrum of the issues that we're addressing, and perhaps put those into a package together that will address our health care needs, that being public health, mental health, safety net clinics, and the Oregon Health Plan. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Alan Melnick. I'm the health officer for Clackamas County, and I'm also vice chair of the Coalition of Local Health Officials, and I'm here representing the Coalition of Local Health Officials who strongly support House Bill 3943. The Department of Human Services requested that local health departments in the state develop public health improvement plans, which we did, and we've identified some significant gaps in the public health system. And I believe the health division can get you copies of the public health improvement plans for each county, as well as the state composite of those plans. A lot of those gaps are related to communicable disease services. House Bill 3943 would provide the resources that would be necessary to help us address a lot of those gaps. Now, you've heard a lot of testimony about the safety net, and sometimes it can get kind of confusing as to what's public health and what's a safety net. The easiest way for me to think about this is to use an analogy of a river, with people drowning in a river as the river is moving downstream. And the safety net basically plucks people out of the river and treats them, keeps them from drowning. What public health does is it looks upstream to figure out why people are falling in the river in the first place. The safety net and the public health system are complementary. It's kind of like if you could think of a four-legged stool with public health, safety net, mental health, and the Oregon Health Plan to help keep Oregonians healthy and safe. Safety net providers, physicians, nurse practitioners that work in safety net agencies diagnose the communicable diseases that are then reported to public health departments. Public health departments gather that data, and they do some analysis and investigation and figure out how to keep the community healthy and prevent communicable diseases
from being spread. So we work with safety net providers to do that. So the system is very complementary. This bill would provide us the resources to keep people from falling into that river and provide look upstream and keep folks healthy. So we strongly urge you to support it.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Gina Furman. I'm the executive director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. The Association of Community Mental Health Programs represents 36 counties and 32 different community mental health programs. We wholeheartedly support House Bill 3943, and we applaud this committee's efforts to lead in sponsoring and supporting this bill. You, the legislature, in your wisdom last session, concluded that money should be taken from the tobacco settlement fund to address community, public, and mental health service gaps. AOCMHP still believes that this is the right solution. Last year, the Department of Human Services directed counties to do a local health improvement plan with a mental health assessment component. The assessments concluded that there are serious gaps in service due to lack of capacity. Douglas, Klamath, and Lane County, along with 27 other counties, identified a crisis triage as one of their top three issues. We are asking for tobacco settlement fund money to address crisis services and also to help community mental health programs shore up preventative and early intervention measures to avoid costlier treatments later on, such as crisis services and serving our mentally ill in jails. The Department of Human Services included a $43 million package in their budget request to the governor. It unfortunately was deleted. The Mental Health Alignment Task Force concluded in their report that 30% of the kids that need services are not getting them for mental illness, and 17% of the adults needing mental health services are not receiving them due to lack of capacity and access issues. The Mental Health Division assigned a number to this and indicated that it would cost about $229 million to service this responsibility. And that's a large number. Our request is only for $15 million for mental health, $15 million for public health, and, hey, I guess $15 million for safety net clinics, if that's what you'd like to do. It will provide the needed start for capacity. It's only a start, but we wanted to thank you for creating House Bill 3943. It is a giant step in the right direction. And in your packets, besides my notes, you will also see testimony submitted by Gilliam County, Hood River, Jackson, Lane, Lincoln, Sherman, Wasco, and Yamhill County. Thank you. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Chairman Cruz, members of the committee, my name is Melinda Mallory. I'm the mental health director for Clackamas County. And the only thing I want to add to this is, the mental health directors are extremely supportive of this, and I think that this bill continues to support the recognition that we have uninsured in Oregon, that we, in mental health, we have people who are underinsured, people who lose their mental health benefit or they use up their mental health benefit and have to fall into the public service system. And I think that that recognition is very important, because I think sometimes with the Oregon Health Plan, there's the feeling that most services are covered for people who are in need, and we all know that is not true. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you very much. I got a question for the sponsor of the bill. How come you left Representative Tomei off? I mean, coincidentally, everybody that signed on the bill is a member of this committee.
Representative, I had to drop. It's a priority bill. It was my priority bill, and I couldn't find Representative Tomei. I only had a certain number of hours to get everyone's signature and get it dropped in time.
Okay, I'm just curious. Bruce Bishop.
Maybe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, here on behalf of Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Northwest. We are not here necessarily to oppose Hospital 3943. In fact, based on the sponsorship, I can count, and I know that that would be a few. And I suspect that we would not even gain Representative Tomei's vote in support of our position. We could, however, like the committee, to put this into some perspective and to take a strategic approach in examining how to spend the tobacco settlement funds that Oregon will be receiving. We think it's important that you try to maximize the use of those resources because they are one of the few pots of additional money that will be available to this assembly this year. And there are a number of ways that that can be done. The Children's Health Insurance Program provides one opportunity to leverage state dollars effectively into an expanded program to serve children. The Medicaid program also provides an attractive match for those resources. And it's the expansion and maintenance of those programs that led Kaiser Permanente to join with the Hospital Association last year in supporting a measure that would have created the Oregon Health Plan Trust Fund. We know that you have other legislation before you that will also address the tobacco settlement funds, but we would urge the committee to think carefully about where those funds should be spent, where they can do the best good, and then once you make a decision about how to spend those monies, make sure that they're delivering the services that you want to buy with them. So it's not that we're opposed to the bill, but we think it is a complicated policy issue, and we would appreciate the opportunity to work with the committee in that regard.
Representative Mona Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I agree wholeheartedly with you, Mr. Fisher and Bishop. And that's why I hopefully that some of those will be addressed in rules, because the way this was written is the plans and policies are going to be developed, and the division will help set that up. The Department of Human Services will allocate, but it needs to be based, the intent of this is to be based on plans and policies, and I think we need for the record to be sure that we want to maximize the dollars. So when the plans come through, if we can get federal match, let's get federal match. But I agree, we don't have an overall plan for our tobacco settlement dollars at all, and there isn't one. Everyone wants a piece of the pie.
Representative Moore, sir.
I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair, say that we do have, this committee passed out an overall plan for tobacco settlement money. We passed it through Ways and Means, and we want to restore. That bill said that we'll restore all of the cuts that were made in the governor's budget. So I consider that an overall plan. There are some additional bills that, in fact, we'll be hearing one first thing tomorrow that will do as this does, only there are some figures in that bill. But I think that we do have a fairly good grasp. And in addition to that, Chair Cruz has a bill that we'll hear later today that I hope adds some positive things to the bills that we've already passed. I think it does. We'll talk about that later. But I feel real good about where we're going on this, because I think we all feel strongly that tobacco settlement money came as a result of damage to people's bodies, often by using tobacco. So there is a direct relation.
This stuff?
And fortunately, we have some people who continue to put money into the fund that we will be using.
So I should be able to say where it goes.
It's your money.
Thank you, Mr. Bishop. One thing this committee will not lack for having suggested vehicles for tobacco settlement in Ways and Means by the time we're done. But you're right, and committee, and that is a discussion we are just now beginning to have as far as budget concerns
are, you know, is what we're going to do with it. And I certainly have some very strong opinions on that, and we'll make sure those are communicated. Thank you, Ruth. There's nobody else signed up to testify, so I will close public hearing on 3943, and I'm going to take a chance and open a work session to see. I don't know where this committee is going to go on this, but Representative Mona Sanderson.
I think we need to pass this out of the committee today.
You're supposed to be making a motion.
I move that we refer House Bill 3943 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Can we have a discussion?
Yes. Let's have it. Okay.
The one you
didn't get.
The one I didn't get.
I really appreciated what Mr. Bishop had to say. I'm wondering if it might be appropriate to add an amendment to the effect of leveraging federal, local, and private resources as much as possible so that there comes a directive with this for local governments to be looking for other funds to help spread these funds even further. Would that be appropriate?
Could I respond to that?
Yeah.
Each county may have different needs, and it could be that the money that would be needed in one county, it would be appropriate that their plan would be to leverage dollars, and in another county, it may not be. That's why I rather than making that statement in as amendment, I like how the bill is written, where the Department of Human Resources would look at the plans from the counties and, based on the merits of the plans, distribute the funds.
And I would point out, committee, that there is kind of a comprehensive mental health planning bill that's in this committee that you don't know this yet, but we will be hearing it next Tuesday night. So it's a product of the governor's mental health work group, and so this kind of a subset, the planning part, this kind of a subset, mm-hmm. probably a bigger effort.
Okay.
I forget the number.
3024.
Okay, yeah, 3024. Thank you very much. Any other discussion? I'm assuming, Representative Tomei, you were just thinking about it. You didn't ask for an amendment.
No, I didn't. I was suggesting it as a possibility, asking what opinion was.
Hearing no further discussion, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3943, having received the required majority, is declared passed, and I will close the work session on House Bill 3943, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2452. Bam. He's right there.
And members of the committee, House Bill 2452 appropriates money from the general fund to the Department of Justice, also known as DOJ, for increased investigations and prosecutions of allegations of provider fraud, abuse, and neglect by the Medical Fraud Unit. It directs Department of Justice to report to the 72nd Legislative Assembly. It declares an emergency. This bill would be effective July 1st, 2001. We have a fiscal that we are passing out to you. It was just received before committee, so I want to make sure that you have that. Would you please make sure the Representative gets a copy? And this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. I gave you some rather comprehensive information from Department of Justice on the medical fraud unit behind the SMS. But you can look at it at your leisure.
Representative Schrader. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Members of the committee, I'm Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. This is a very simple bill, colleagues. For a mere $250,000 investment, we should be able to easily, I think, double the return on criminal and particularly civil judgments. Currently, the state billing fraud unit has been very, very successful compared to a few years ago with a similar increase in money. My interest in this bill is in response to an article from the Oregonian this spring, and I believe members have had an opportunity to look at that. Basically, our fraud unit is one of the nation's smallest, and I believe it's fourth from the bottom or close to the bottom in relation to the size of our Medicaid program. What the article indicated was that we just have not been very, very successful or very vigilant in or aggressive in dealing with our provider fraud situation here in the state of Oregon. Matter of fact, the U.S. General Accounting Office reported that fraud may be costing Oregon up to $100 million annually. With rising costs of medical care, I believe we have to be very, very vigilant in controlling the escalating costs and prosecute individuals to the fullest extent. OMAP is fairly preoccupied dealing with the Oregon Health Plan itself. It has not had a great track record. I believe the article talks about its own fraud unit being scrapped in 1984 after having pursued all of two cases over a 20-year period. One could argue there's even potentially a conflict of interest in investigating it amongst themselves. The last time this budget was increased was in the mid-90s, and our state coverage went from approximately $100,000 in billing fraud to almost $1 million. We have a tremendous opportunity, I think, to leverage some dollars here and husband our precious general fund dollars. In addition to the dollars that we save with the Oregon Health Plan across the state, some of the recovery dollars can be used to offset the costs of this very same program, thereby saving us general fund dollars once again. Another point I think that's important to make here is that the Medicaid Fraud Unit has been very concerned about dealing with these issues across the state. While there are some very big recoveries, part of their program, part of their effort is to just dissuade and deter this in the first place by pursuing a number of slightly smaller cases all across the state to send a message to the providers that Oregon will not tolerate this sort of abuse. So quite frankly, the old adage that it takes money to make money, I think, applies here, colleagues. Again, for a fairly modest investment, I think we can do quite well. The track record in 94 and 95, I think, is emblematic of what we can do here at the turn of the new century. Billing fraud for state programs was $107,000 worth of recoveries. For criminal cases, $172,000 for civil cases in 1995. Here, after they got a boost in their budget in 96-97 time period, our state recoveries went to up to $460,000 for criminal and $1 million for civil. And that's just the state recoveries. The feds, which are also taxpayers, went to $148,000 and almost $8 million in recoveries. So there's great potential here. This is one of those bills, I think, that is a simple no-brainer that's just going to make us money in the long run.
Question. Representative Grove.
Representative Schrader, I need to be educated a little bit. How many people does the fraud unit have? When I look at 31 cases for prosecution in a year, I think, wow, that's all we have?
Alan, would you like to come up?
Yeah. Ms. Sternfield would probably be better to answer that than I.
Well, I doubt that.
Oh, I don't.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Representative Girard. To answer your question, our current staffing is at 7.5 people FTE, which includes three attorneys, one of whom is myself, and I also function as the unit director and have a number of administrative responsibilities. Because we are 75% federally funded, I like to say I answer to two masters. One is Attorney General Myers, and the other is the Inspector General for HHS, who controls my budget strengths. We carry an average open caseload at a time of about 50 cases, and with turnover and things like that, we usually handle about 75 cases a year. Several of those we normally find after full investigation it is inappropriate to prosecute for a number of reasons. Billing fraud can be complicated, there can be a lot of red tape, and there may be honest errors, or there may be errors that because of evidentiary reasons we can't prosecute. In those cases, we will send back to the appropriate state agency with a recommendation to pursue administrative recoupment. With the staffing of three attorneys, which we've had for the past 2 years, we've handled about an average of about 40 cases, resulting in some court action in a year, be it a civil judgment, an indictment, a conviction, something along those lines. We carry a number of cases, as Representative Schrader indicated, which may be smaller in nature. It may be an in-home care provider who billed for services after their client died. It may be an in-home care provider who billed for services while they were incarcerated. We carry a number of patient abuse cases that are fiduciary in nature. We have a case in Umatilla County right now with an in-home care provider who used her client's ATM card to play video poker and gamble, totally decimating the client's assets and rendering her totally dependent upon public assistance. Those are somewhat more complicated. And then our complex billing fraud cases can take a couple of years to see into fruition. So we carry a balance of cases.
Okay. Could you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry. I'm Ellen Sternfield. I am the director of the Oregon Department of Justice Medicaid Fraud Unit. Thank you, and I apologize, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. Ellen, could you tell me a little bit more about the process? Who brings complaints to you, and what happens to them, et cetera?
Sure. We get complaints from numerous sources. The first is the Oregon Department of Human Services. We actually have a one-page referral form that all local county workers have. So if they see something when they're out in the field or somebody comes to their attention, they can send a matter to our attention. The Office of Medical Assistance Program has an audit program. They send referrals to us. Interestingly enough, in the year 2000, we got more complaints from average citizens, from people calling up than we'd ever gotten before, in part because billing fraud has a much higher profile. We work very closely with the Office of Inspector General for the Healthcare Financing Administration, has three special agents in the Portland office. The FBI has several agents devoted to healthcare fraud, and the U.S. Attorney's Office has several attorneys who work on healthcare fraud. And we work on some of the larger cases in partnership with them. We completed a case last year that brought over $400,000 back to Oregon that involved a durable medical equipment company that was brought to us by our counterparts in Washington State. The company was actually based in Vancouver. They were in the process of investigating the entity and discovered that they were billing to the Medicaid program and notified us. We have a very strong network of our counterparts in the other states. And finally, some of the larger cases also come to us from the U.S. Department of Justice. Many of you may have read about the Columbia HCA case that involves massive billing fraud around the country. We have two small Columbia hospitals in Oregon. Several of the issues that were settled recently with Columbia, we had some damages from, and I work with the U.S. Justice Department and my counterparts in other states on these larger cases to ensure that Oregon Medicaid's interests are protected and any recoveries come back to our program.
One more. You had the two setups. Here comes the... This bill asks for increased funding. What can we expect? If we give you more money, what are you going to do with it?
First thing I'm going to do is take more of the cases that I've been turning away solely due to lack of resources. I'm going to increase our prosecutions around the state and hopefully increase our recoveries. It's almost impossible for me to put a dollar amount, and I'm sure that's what you'd like to see, for me to tell you I'm going to get you X amount of bang for your buck. One of the reasons I can't do that is because some of our worst cases, we're not going to see the money back from. We did a case in Lane County a couple of years ago involving two individuals who we determined built a number of Oregon programs, including the Medicaid program, and unemployment and a number of other programs for over $100,000. We got $5,000 back in restitution. However, we also put those individuals in jail. And made sure that they cannot be in a position to build these programs again. Had we not prosecuted those cases, who knows what they would be doing, how much more money would have been lost. And it was important to us, we felt, to utilize our resources, even though we knew at the end of the day the dollar recovery, because of the ability to pay, was not going to be that great. But number one, we were going to send a message, and number two, we were going to at least stop these individuals from their contact. I can tell you that I believe that once we get people on board and trained and versed in this area of the law, which is unique really to what we do, I believe that we can handle at least 30 to 40 more cases a year. And I think we will see significant increase in our recovery. Our track record shows that when we increase staff, we increased recoveries. I'd like to think that within a five-year period that we will be able to see a significant increase in recoveries as well as cases prosecuted. But it would not be realistic for me to put a dollar figure on that for you.
I'll help, if that's okay, Mr. Chair, put a dollar figure on that, because I think that is important, and I respect the reticence of DOJ to go there. But, for instance, the largest 2,000 civil judgment was a culmination of several years' effort with Beverly Enterprises, netted $1 million to the state of Oregon. So, I mean, there is an opportunity there, I think, to do quite well. And that's only one case. Big case, mind you, but one case. So we'll easily get our money back and then some.
You know, I think it's inappropriate to look at this as a revenue source. I think this is...
I'm on Ways and Means, Mr. Chair, so...
Accountability issue to make sure that
it is
we are spending in our healthcare system is spent appropriately.
Right. Absolutely.
Because there's a double cost here. There's not only the money that you may get back, but there's the money that shouldn't go out.
That's right.
So, Representative Barnes.
And Mr. Chair, I did ask to be on the Revenue Committee, so I don't mind pretending that we are one for the day.
Well, you know, we were land use last week. What the heck?
Yeah. Called multitasking, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. You missed that. You would have loved it. Any other questions?
Great.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2452, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2452. I'm sure, colleagues, you've had a chance to read all the information behind the SNS here. Representative Tomei.
I'd like to move House Bill 2452 to the Ways and Means Committee with the DuPac recommendation.
Representative Tomei has moved House Bill 2452 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a DuPac recommendation. Any discussion? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Yes. Was this in the governor's budget or the co-chair's budget?
No.
No?
No.
Okay. I definitely want to vote for this. I have a concern because it's not in the budget, anyone's budget, and we will just wait and see what the Ways and Means people will do with it.
We sent them a lot of bills that aren't in the budget.
Yes, we have sent them a lot of bills.
And Representative, I would point out that this, in all likelihood, will end up in the Ways and Means subcommittee that Representative Schrader sits on. So I think there's
forget a, about
I
think, that. All
I think
right,
he's got a plan here.
All right.
Any other discussion?
Well, it sounded to me as though he basically promised to raise more money than we're going to
spend. That's what he said.
So
can't lose.
We need
okay. Call the roll.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative
Morse. Oh.
Excuse.
Representative
Gerard. Aye.
Representative
Moss
Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Lee?
Aye.
Representative Barnhart?
Aye.
Chair Cruz?
Aye. House Bill 2452, having received the required majority, is declared passed. I will close the work session on House Bill 2452. What are we going to do with all this extra money, is what I want.
Yeah, right.
We're right. Oh, we are ahead of schedule, aren't we?
Well,
we
just go on.
That's all right.
Yeah, let's finish that. Let's go. We're on a roll.
Okay, colleagues, I am going to, surprise, surprise, the next bill, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2519, and I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2519. This will, in all likelihood, become the Medicaid waiver bill. So we need, and I know you've been worried, Scott, but I said I wasn't going to do anything. So, I just need the vehicle in committee for when we get that waiver crafted.
Oh, I see. You were after a relating clause.
Yes, I was.
I got it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We might actually get
You're right. Good relief. And they can be really scary the way they're drafted. Just breathe right through.
Here, and I don't know if amendments can come forward, but we could try it and get the committee at ease if we can get it.
Yeah, we're going to let the committee stand at ease for a few minutes. We have moved quicker than I thought we were going to. I want to see, because the rest of the agenda was scheduled for later, and I want to see if we can contact those who are interested and see if it fits in their schedule to do it now. So
great.
I could give you the evening off.
Yeah,
let's take a 10-minute recess.